Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of the Leaders in Value Chain podcast. I am your host, Rado Palamariu, and with a super exciting guest, we have joining, I think all the way from Hawaii, Guy Kawasaki, who is the, you'll tell me if it's true or not in a moment. So Guy Kawasaki, he needs no further introduction, but just for those of you who just in the odd chance don't know all of the things he's done, here's a snippet. I'll start with a short bio. He's the chief evangelist of Canva. I think it's a tool that many of us use, dear to my heart for sure, and our marketing team, they love it. He's also the creator of Guy Kawasaki's Remarkable People podcast, an executive fellow of the Haas School of Business for the University of California, an adjunct professor at the University of New South Wales. He was chief evangelist at Apple as well. He is a trustee of the Wikimedia Foundation, has written many cool books, and the latest one, which is Think Remarkable, we will be talking at length about it today. So Guy, pleasure to have you. Thanks for joining.
Oh, it's my pleasure. What better way to spend an afternoon? I'm in California, by the way.
There you go. But you were born in Hawaii. So there,
I was born in Hawaii.
just a position in my mind. Now I took time and I read your long bio on the website. So you have a long bio on your website, and I don't know if you wrote it. I believe you did. It was one of my favorite bios to read, and I just want to spend, if you're okay, just want to spend some snippets. I won't read all of it, but there's some snippets that really cracked me up, Guy. So okay. I just have to share it with the whole audience.
I did write it, by the way.
I was sure you did. Yeah. So, you know, you share a little bit of where you started the school and so on. And then you say that you attended Stanford, yeah, in 1976 with a major in psychology, which Guy says was the easiest major he could have found at the time. Then after Stanford, you attended the law school, yeah, because his parents wanted him to be a doctor, lawyer, or dentist. However, he only lasted 1 week because he couldn't deal with the law school teachers telling him that he was crap and they were going to remake him. So lovely mantra. I stand by that as well, Guy. Don't listen to people that tell you crap. Then it gets even better. So Guy enters the MBA program at UCLA, likes the curriculum better. He works for a fine jewelry manufacturer. So for everybody listening to this, I think this is quite cool. Yeah. So Guy came from jewelry, yeah, Nova Stylings. His first real job, counting diamonds. So not a bad job at all. And then you say that you learned how to sell. So we'll go into that because it's also one of the chapters in the book, right? Then you say that you went in to work for an educational company, Eduware, and they wanted you to move to Atlanta. Here's another piece that I absolutely loved. You said, I don't think so. It was your reaction because you couldn't live in a city where people call sushi bait. And I stand by that as well, Guy. You should not do that. If they don't appreciate sushi, screw them. And I'll read just one more. Luckily, his Stanford roommate, Mike Boych, got Guy a job at Apple. So one could make the case that Guy owes Mike everything. When Guy saw what a Macintosh could do, the clouds parted and the angels started singing. For 4 years, Guy evangelized Macintosh to developers, and he also met his wife at Apple during this time frame. Apple was very good to Guy. So this was in the 1980s. So I'll stop there, but I absolutely love these pieces. There's quite a few more. So for those of you watching this, read the long bio of Guy on his website because it's just wonderful.
Okay. I wrote that bio and it took me a while. So and you know what? A lot of places where I speak, they copy that bio and they read that bio to introduce me to.
But it's brilliant. I mean, it's just simply...
Nothing like having to dig yourself out of a hole before you speak.
I'll start here because it's something that... So what we deal with in general at Elcott Global, a lot of corporate environments, we do executive search, we do headhunting for top-level positions. And I am a little bit frustrated. I'll owe that. And I'll start there. With the lack
I'm not
of
your fun. Psychiatrist.
No. I actually studied psychology myself as well, right? Also because it was easy. So we we align on that. But I think there's a lack of fun, Guy. I think it's a very serious, tends to be. I don't want to overgeneralize, but it tends to be a fairly serious environment in most companies. And I'd love just to start there on what do you think the purpose of fun and just having a fun environment, does that help leadership? Does that help companies? Does it make it cooler to work or not?
I mean, I cannot build a case where purposely making your company not a fun place and a place people don't like to be is productive. I mean, what kind of reverse law? Maybe that's true of the Republican Party in the United States, but other than that, I mean, it should be fun to go to work. And you know, people, I think I learned from Steve Jobs that people want to believe in what they do. And I think that fun, which is kind of the flip side of a sense of humor, I think that a sense of humor that is the ability to make people laugh and the ability to know when something is funny is a sign of intelligence. And so when you meet people who cannot crack a joke and they cannot take a joke and they cannot laugh at a joke, I think you're probably dealing with stupid people, quite frankly.
Or insecure. So stupidity is one. I think insecurity, and you talk also about embrace vulnerability, right? In the book. I think it probably is insecurity in my mind, and I'd love your thoughts, right? Because I come across sometimes, you know, it's a CEO or a board member. If they are overly serious, I'm like, what's your problem? You know, I mean, like,
Yeah,
what, how
I
are you gonna,
mean,
yeah.
I would say that the person who is insecure and cannot take a joke, cannot make a joke, they probably are insecure and they're probably stupid. I mean, so that's a deadly combination. You know, if you're stupid but secure, okay. And if you're secure, but you're not, but you're smart, that's okay. Or I guess a secure, stupid person isn't. No, that's not a
You
good
have a few
combination
running
either.
for pre you have a few running for president, guy, huh?
I'm telling you, I'd rather have an old president than a crooked one, but that I digress. Yeah.
Fair enough. Then I know in and I want to bring to you know bring the topic to Think Remarkable, and I've gone through a little bit the, I haven't yet fully read the book. I've ordered it. I saw the summary of the book. I listened to some of the interviews that you've already given on the book, and of course, the book is at the back of you know you've done a remarkable job of having some amazing people on your podcast, yeah, on the Remarkable People podcast. In the book, you talk about don't follow your passion,
Yes.
and I want you to share some anecdotes about that because we have you know a lot of people listening to this, a lot of young people listening to this. It tends to be more you know more evangelized when you're young than when you're older,
Yeah.
perhaps, but I think
Okay.
tell us a little bit.
So it's not that I don't want you to follow your passions. I don't want you to set such a high bar for what you follow, having to be your passion, because it sets a bar that's artificially high and is probably going to lead to frustration. It's as if that, you know, people are expected to quote find their passion, and it's an instantaneous fall in love. I mean, to use a dating analogy, it would be like saying to somebody, you're 20 years old. You haven't found the man or the woman that you're going to spend the rest of your life with. What's wrong with you? You know, you need to get out there and find your passion. You need to find your woman. You find your man. And I'm telling you, when you're young, you should do a lot of sampling, which is, I don't know, that word might not fit too well with dating, but it's sampling. That's what you're doing. And so I think the same thing is true. So rather than trying to find your quote passion where you passionately fall in love and you know that's the rest of your life, I think you should have an open growth mindset. And when things come across your radar that interests you, I want you to have an open mind and pursue your interests. And it could be writing, speaking, videography, it could be art, it could be surfing, it could be, you know, it could be accounting for all I know. But when something interests you, pursue that. And over the course of a lifetime, with a lot of sampling of a lot of interests, may you discover three or four passions. But don't set yourself up for failure by saying, oh, I'm going to find my passion. It's going to be the one true love of my life, and it's going to be instant, and I'm going to instantly be good at it, because it ain't going to happen that way.
And I want to double click a little bit and bring it to you, because you for sure are a man of many passions. And, you know, you've gone from jewelry to technology to selling computers to building software to, well, you know, Now you're also, we didn't mention, but you're also an evangelist for Mercedes. So you probably like cars as well, or you must, because, okay.
Well, there's two factors to that. One is that I truly do believe in the growth mindset. So when I encounter something that I find interesting, I dive in. So I took up ice hockey at the age of 44. I took up surfing at the age of 60. And let's just say that that's not typical age for people to take up sports like 44, like hockey and surfing. So that's one thing, you know, why I appear to have so many different interests. The other thing is that, frankly, I'm old. I'm 69 years old, so I've had a lot of time to do sampling. If I were 29 and I had already tried all these things, you might say, yeah, guy, I mean, you really are a remarkable sampler. But I've just had a long time to sample things. Now, if you're young, if you're 20, some, you know, or 18 or something, and you're listening to this, so your lifespan is probably going to be 90 years, right? So you have another 60, 70 years to try shit. So you ought to like try as much as you can, because you got a long life. You know, you don't need to like get into a rut or a box soon.
Now, you know, myself, I didn't know it at that time. I super resonate with what you just said. So I was a Generation Y, or fairly typical. I think I had 5-6 jobs in 5 years at some point. Eventually, I settled to exec search about 10, 15 years ago. But I can't imagine that it was easy. For me, okay, maybe the times has changed and I was very lucky. But in your day and age, yeah, when, you know, this was quite a few years back, I don't think it was very typical that for a person to do so many things, even if you're now downplaying it a little bit. You've tried quite a few things early on. How was it? And I would want to potentially put this context of, I think there's this big social construct that society puts on us of what you should do, how you should be, how you should live. How was it for you, and what helped you break free? Because I'm sure you had some limiting beliefs at that time.
You know, I think it's your life. You should live it the way you like. And that often includes defying your parents. And I cannot tell you that I had an overall like life plan to, you know, go from jewelry to computers to software to internet to podcasting and writing and speaking. Things just appeared to me and they interested me and I did them. I mean, it's that simple. I do not and did not have a life plan. And, you know, God bless you if you can execute on a life plan. I think you're going to have a very boring life. But I think that, you know, a lot of what determines success is that you're in the right place at the right time. And you are willing to grow and you are willing to take a risk. The concept of you graduate from college and then you go to work for a Fortune 500 company for the next 25 years and you retire, that's long gone, long gone. I mean, over the course of the career of someone in their 20s right now, you're probably going to have 6 to 10 jobs, right? So, I mean, this also has an amazing ramification, which is that don't sweat your first couple jobs. Like a lot of people believe in college, oh my God, you know, I'm graduating, I got to make the perfect choice, you know, because I'm going to stay at this company the rest of my life. And you're deluding yourself. I mean, you need to just chillax and, you know, pursue your interests. You got a lot of time.
And a lot of the people that follow us are from a background of value chain, supply chain, manufacturing, operations, right? The people that build stuff or move stuff, right? Transportation. I want to bring you to the chapter 6 of your book, which is Sell Your Dream. And specifically in this profession of supply chain operations, they tend to be people that do shit, not so much talk about shit, let alone brag about the shit they did. Yeah. So I just want to, you know, I'm using this channel to also hopefully inspire some people to, hey, come on, guys. Yeah. So talk to us a little bit about sell your dream part.
Well, you know, that it takes a lot to make this world work. And, you know, it's not all designers and it's not all influencers on TikTok. I mean, somebody's actually got to build the shit. And to build the shit, somebody's got to supply and it's got to go through that chain. And, you know, I think we all learned a valuable lesson when one ship got stuck in the Suez Canal, like the whole world ground to a halt, right? I mean, you talk about, you know, everybody should have asked for a raise back then in the supply chain
they did,
management
some did,
business.
Some did.
And you know, like, I mean, seriously, there are some people, let's take engineering, for example. There's two kinds of engineers, right? So one engineer wants to write the first version of something and trailblazing, right? But you know what? After you have version one, it takes a different kind of mindset to have version 1.1, 1.2, 2.0, 3.0, 4.0. And listen, it's very important to get version one, but it's also important to get version 3 and 4 and 5. But I think that takes a different kind of mindset. And it's not that one is more valuable than the other. I mean, both are necessary. So as I've gotten older and older, one of the things that I appreciate more and more is that I have come to believe that everybody you meet, literally everybody you meet, can do something better than you. So if you think that you are just God's gift to mankind, you are full of shit. Because, you know, that flight attendant that you just yelled at, she might be a better surfer than you. Or, you know, that waiter that you just yelled at, he might be a better photographer than you. Or maybe he makes tacos better than you. Or maybe he's a better father than you or a coach than you. So, like, you know, you ought to chillax and not think that the freaking world revolves around you, because it doesn't. And everybody you meet is probably better than you at something. And yeah, I mean, at an extreme, let's say you're a billionaire, private equity or, you know, hedge fund manager, and you think you are just the center of the universe. And you know what? You ain't, because everybody you meet can do something better than you.
I love it. My favorite quotes from you is, if you don't toot your own horn, don't complain that there's no music.
Yes.
And I wanted to get to see if you have one or two anecdotes, because I believe that to be very true. There's a lot of people that, as long as I do good work, somebody will see me and promote me.
Well,
I'm not too sure.
Well, let me tell you something. So first of all, I would rather have someone doing good work who doesn't know how to toot their horn than someone who toots their horn but doesn't do good work. It's much easier to fix the horn tooting than the work, okay? So if you are a person who does good work but doesn't do your horn tooting, that's really easy to fix. But if you're just doing shit and you can toot your horn, that's really hard to fix, let me tell you. So I, you know, it sort of comes back to what I just said, that you should be proud of your interests, and knock on wood, some of those interests turn into passions. And it's, I think another thing I realized is that, you know, sometimes you know other employees and they're not quite as dedicated as you, and they're not, you know, trying to strive to be the top and all that. And you think, what's wrong with this person? This person doesn't have ambition, or, you know, this person is not as intelligent or whatever than me, right? And I've also figured out that you don't know what's going on in that person's life, right? So you think, why isn't this person putting in the overtime and working hard and, you know, rising up the corporate ladder? Well, maybe he or she is a single parent. Maybe he or she is a single parent caring for two generations, one older than you and one younger than you. Or maybe that person just looks at a job as a way to put food on the table, but their true passion is ceramics or something. Like, who are you to judge what's important to another person?
You talk about embracing vulnerability in one of the chapters in the book.
Yeah.
And specifically, I think there's a big gender, there's big gender discrepancies as well. And I heard you say at some point, I listened to you saying that you believe that women are definitely, you know, so one, they might be vulnerable, but two, there's definitely a lot of gender-based also attacks and discrimination and so on. So I wanted to bring that topic. I also believe that is true, and get your perspective specifically on gender.
Yeah, well, I have lots of thoughts here. So first of all, yeah. I think that men have screwed up the world for 2,000 years. So now let's just let women run the world for 2,000 years. Let's see what happens, because can't get any worse. I mean, I just think men are, we're at the edge of maybe the end of mankind, like literally, especially in the United States, literally we could be, you know, at a crisis point. So I say, let's let women run the companies and run the countries. Okay. That's number one. Number two is that in all the positions I've held and all my background, the gating item is not money. It's really talent, right? So if you have talent, everything else flows. And so I also believe that talent is kind of uniformly and randomly distributed among genders and sexual orientations and religions and skin color and all that. So it seems to me, if you figured out that the hard part is building a great team, why would you eliminate half the genetic pool by saying we're only going to recruit men, or we're only going to recruit white men, or we're only going to recruit white men who went to Ivy League schools like I did? Like, you know, you just wiped out a lot of people who would be very valuable. So why would you do something that stupid? And yeah, but, you know, clearly there are entire political parties in the United States who believe that, right? Like, I don't understand this. It's just not rational to me. And I'm a rational person. It's not rational to me to have some of these stupid rules and, you know, just these, like, just putting people into a box. I do not understand that at all.
And further on the topic of vulnerability at the workplace, yeah? There's been quite a few, if you read the articles, and that's why I'm a little bit, again, fed up with the political correctness. And so there's, you know, what companies say they do and what they actually do. But what they say they do, or they say they want to do, maybe more accurately, yes, embrace vulnerability, you know, show that you're human. Then you go in, and especially in this hyper-competitive, you know, stock-listed company, forget
yeah.
that. I mean, you say that you don't know, they like, yeah. they crucify you. Yeah? So talk a little bit to this, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, this book is based on my podcast, where I've interviewed about 250 remarkable people like Jane Goodall, Steve Wozniak, Margaret Atwood, Stephen Wolfram, you know, MacArthur Fellow Awards, all these people. And every one of them, every stinking one of them had a growth mindset. And so the flip side of having a growth mindset, believing you can learn new skills and stuff, is to embrace vulnerability, because when you try something new, you will suck at it. So you need to be able to embrace vulnerability. If you take up surfing at 60, you need to be able to say to yourself, I know I'm going to get hurt. I know I'm going to be embarrassed, and still I'm going to do it. And that is just the key. Now, but I have a further refinement on the growth mindset, which I learned just in about a month ago, which is, it's not, the growth mindset is primarily in your head, right? Do you believe you can grow? But in order for you to grow, you also need to be in an environment that supports growth, because you could be in a company that doesn't support growth. They believe that, you know, they hired people who are proven geniuses, and those proven geniuses, they don't need to learn anything more. And those proven geniuses also cannot deteriorate, because they're a proven genius. You know, that's like a God-given thing. And so if you have that attitude, now, if you're not marked as a proven genius on day one, they believe that you cannot ever achieve greater things. And so maybe, you know, maybe you're hired as a secretary or a, you know, operator or customer service or shipping and handling. And they believe, well, that's the peons. You know, those are the mediocre people. No one can progress from that. Only the geniuses are geniuses. I mean, just everything I just said just makes me want to throw up. And so what I'm trying to tell you is that you need a growth mindset in your head, but you also need to be in a growth environment. So the question is, how do you determine if you're in a growth environment? And I think there's two ways. One is you look at Glassdoor and you see what people say on Glassdoor. That's number one. But number two, I think that, you know, you look at the management and is it diverse? Is it 90% white males, right? I mean, that's not a good sign because it's not like only white males have intelligence and competence. I think it's randomly and evenly distributed. And so from the outside looking in, you read Glassdoor, you look at their management. And then I hate to say this because in like eight states, they're trying to kill it. But you look at DEI programs. Are there DEI programs? So people around the world, they might not be familiar with the term DEI. It's for diversity, equality, and inclusion. And basically what it means is there are programs for LGBTQ plus people, for minorities, for, you know, all the people that are not the so-called proven geniuses. And if you see a lot of DEI programs and a lot of programs about training and development, it's a signal that this company believes in the growth of its employees. And if you don't see those kind of programs, then it means that the company does not believe in growth. And if you have a growth mindset, you might be very unhappy there.
I'll play devil advocate for just a second. And let me see how I frame this because I'm entering dangerous territory, but I'll do it because it's a cool conversation. So I'm with you, and I'm, you know, we have a super diverse team. We have, you know, in Alcott we have I believe we walk the talk. Yeah, we don't have just, you know, people like me. I mean, I'm a little bit the minority. I would say, on the flip side, to the point that you said that there are, you know, you should look at what are they doing to encourage diversity and inclusion, and it's in diversity inclusion. There's other topics as well. Yeah, I'll name one, right? Sustainability. Very important topics, don't get me wrong, and I think we should definitely zero in on it. I won't name the company, but I'll put it on the topic of sustainability, right? Because there's one company that went very among the first in the world. Yeah, they went sustainability in our products and so on, and it was brilliant. Yeah, and I mean they almost led the way to the whole industry, and then at some point they drank too much Kool-Aid, you know, guy. They where it went to, okay, now it's flipped to, we are very good at this as humans, right? We are not good at balance. We are extremely good at going from one extreme to the other, right? So they went too far out. And then what happened? Well, you know, margins eroded. Shareholders at some point, like, hey, guys, yeah, your sustainability, sure, but make money. Huh? I mean, it is a business after all, right? So if you just say that you're sustainable, but you're not making money. Now they, you know, there's a new management coming in. Cost cut, you know, they basically went from here to so I feel there's a little bit of also that risk with DEI. I mean, again, to your point, like, let's have women rule the world because men already, we know what they did or what we did. I don't, but there's, you know, there's that balancing act which is kind of hard, and we also enter a space where it's too much, right? It can be too much. So I just want to, I'm
yeah, well,
framing it as much
okay
as I can, but yeah.
Granted, intellectually, I agree that it can be too much, but let's just say that there are probably not too many examples of companies who died because they were too diverse or companies that died because they were too worried about sustainability, right? I mean, there's a lot. There are more companies who died because of the greed of the top management than because they were over diverse. I mean, listen, I'm not saying any company should die at all, but I mean, if you're going to die because you were too diverse or too sustainable, then I think that's pretty much okay. But, you know, Most companies die because of greed, not because of the greed or stupidity. The greed is easy to understand. Stupidity is when you no longer grow, right? You know, you're not innovative. You just like Blockbuster, where you rented DVDs. Why didn't Blockbuster become Netflix? Right? Because, you know, Blockbuster, they looked at their business as we have brick and mortar stores where people come in, they rent the DVD, they return the other one, they go home and they plug it in and they watch, right? So they defined their business in terms of brick and mortar stores. But if they were working back from the customer, if they were truly realizing what the customer was getting like convenient forms of entertainment, right? That's what they wanted. Well, if you think about it for 30 seconds, what's more convenient than streaming? I mean, how can you compare getting in your car, driving to the Blockbuster store, parking, going inside, looking at a limited line of, you know, DVDs on the wall, standing in line, checking it out, going home, sticking it in your TV, coming back, parking again, turning it in, or you can click on stream. Like, how can you possibly believe that that is not a better model? Well, that's just plain stupidity, right? I mean, I
Yeah.
don't know what to say.
And there's so many examples, right? I mean, there's so many. Kodak, I mean, they had
Yes.
even the technology
Kodak.
then.
Kodak invented
Like,
the digital camera, Radu. They invented the digital camera and they died because they wanted to stick with film. I do not understand that.
but so hear me out for a second, because I've been again horrified the last 3 months. So I talked to, you know, a lot of executives, and I'm 95% in the last 3 months. That's why it's also the frequency of this conversation is what a little bit scares me. Because in the last 3 months alone, it's more or less the same pattern where I talk to a frustrated board member or CEO, regardless of the industry almost. And they tell me, rather, this is getting out of hand, right? The board wants, you know, shareholder value, la la, but that's what quarter by quarter by quarter, right? Long term, we're taking stupid decisions. So, and some of them said, look, I throw in the towel, I'm out. I cannot stand in front of my team to explain logically why we do what we do. And 5%, you know, there's some, I'll name one, right? I had a discussion with an executive of Microsoft. At least, you know, I was like, okay, long term. Yeah, I'm like, whoa, there's at least, you know, some that still think long term. But it's almost like a disease of boards that by and large and CEOs thinking short term, shareholder, you know, window dressing, basically, like taking
Yeah.
decisions to kind of, how do
Well,
you.
number one is that it's much easier to be a writer than a CEO. That's why I'm a writer. Okay. So that coupled with that is the fact that, you know, I bet you these CEOs who are saying this, they have a completely undiversified executive staff and board of directors. Well, maybe if they had some diversification, they would be in a stronger position. Duh. I mean, you know, did you ever think of that? And so that's another data point. Another data point is, listen, those CEOs, they're making one, two, three, five, $25 million a year. You expect me to have sympathy for them? Frick. I mean, you know, put on your big boy pants and just be a freaking leader. My God, that's what you get the big bucks for, right? So tough shit is my answer to that. And I think, listen, if it was an easy job, more people would do it and you wouldn't have to pay people as much to do it. That's why you get the big bucks. So don't complain to me about how hard it is. That's what it is. Now, you can make the case that the financial markets where they want good results every 90 days. I mean, listen, you bought into that game, right? I mean, you entered that game. When you were negotiating your CEO package, you were negotiating for stock options, right? I mean, so yeah, so when the stock options go up and you get a lot of money, you like the 90-day reporting and financial markets and public markets. But when you don't deliver results and your options go down and everything, like now, oh, the game is rigged. This is an unfair game. I mean, freaking cry, don't cry for me, Argentina. I mean, give me a break. Want to know how I really feel?
Oh, fair point. I guess I'm almost wondering. So no sympathy for the CEOs. I mean, I think the most blatant injustice, I would call it. If not, I can't come up with a better word, or with a stronger word. The guy at Boeing walking away with 20, 30, 40, I don't know. I mean, they're
Oh,
discussing the
the
package. I mean,
severance.
yeah, like what? Like he should go to jail. Like, I mean, like what do you mean that you're walking away with tens of millions for what? Like for planes, you know, which doors jump, I mean, fly off, or people getting
Listen,
hurt,
I
people
mean
die.
it, but you know, this is, you hear this kind of story all the time, right? So if you screw up big enough, you get compensated. But you gotta really screw up. You cannot kind of screw up, right? You cannot just retire as a semi-successful CEO. You really gotta screw up. And I guess well, you're a headhunter. You can explain this better to me. But you know, I guess the intellectual reason is we take highly successful executives and we ask them to leave their successful positions and take a risk and go to another company. So in order to get that kind of talent, we have to have these golden parachutes that protect them in case, you know, they get fired or whatever. But and I don't have a lot of sympathy for that. If you screw up big enough, I mean, if you screw up big enough, you should get nothing.
Yeah,
I mean,
there should be a
I don't
clause in there.
understand
Like,
that
come on,
either.
like there should be a clause. But I guess what I'm saying, and I mean, back to let's talk, take our job, right? And when we place people, we always conduct informal ref checks, and I strongly believe in that. Formal ref checks, no, nobody's gonna put people that talk badly about them. Nobody's dumb,
Right,
and especially at
right.
the executive level, duh. So when you do informal checks, you know, you ask their boss, fine, but people tend to be good at managing upwards, so I trust that a little bit, not a lot. Peers, yeah, that's where it gets a lot more, you know, a lot more real. Subordinates, that's where it really gets real, right? Because that's where the reality kicks in, because you don't pretend to your subordinate, right? They report to you, no need. So that's where if you ask a few subordinates, you really get a sense, is this person a good leader? Was he a dictator, you know, harsh or whatever it was? So we try to do that all the time because it's part of what we believe we paid for. Now, that doesn't really happen at scale somehow. I'm shocked. Like it's, and even, I mean, I have, you know, in fairness, I've seen my own advice ignored because, you know, nepotism or whatever. Like, you know. So that's where there's an element of that. And there's these circles of people that we discussed a little bit, you know, oh, my body this, my body that, la la la. Okay, fine. And then you have this system, this capitalistic system, where I'm not here to start a revolution, but I'm almost just wondering, are we reaching the end of this quarter by quarter results of, you know, just making more money? I mean, it's like, where does meaning and where does impact come into play? How do we even measure that, right? In a way.
It's hard to imagine that we're coming to the end of this kind of system because there's too many people invested in the system continuing as is. I mean, you know, with Boeing, it's obvious because the freaking, you know, the window pops out, right? I mean, you know, that's hard to hide that. But you know, I mean, if you're the executive of a Fortune 500 company and you don't see the switch to electric cars, or you don't see cloud-based computing coming, or something like that. I mean, isn't that your job? What else can you say? Well, you know, for people listening, they're wondering, what the hell does this have to do with Thinking Remarkable? And I got to tell you, this book is not meant for Fortune 500 CEOs who want to protect their stock option plan. I mean, that's 500 people I'm willing to lose as potential readers of my book.
You'll do just fine. Now, Guy, among final questions for you, if you were to give some pieces of advice of how could a young professional starting in their career, or entrepreneur, or even student, but really the core, you know, you have a lot of gems in the book. When you distill it, what's your favorite or one, two, you know, go
Okay,
to?
so I have two pieces of advice. The first piece of advice, people may be shocked to hear, but I will tell you that your job, this is for the student or the person, you know, early in his career, her career, Your job is to make your boss look good. That's your job. I think many people have this really stupid belief of my job is to show my boss up. I want to show people that I'm better than my boss because they're going to fire my boss and promote me in his or her place. I have never, ever, ever seen that happen. So I'm telling you that your job is to make your boss look good. And when your boss look good, you look good. And when your boss progresses, you progress. You just tag along with your boss as long as he or she is making progress. And then someday your boss is going to be so successful that you can just bask in their halo and you can get another job at another company because you work for a very successful person and help make them successful. You're going to get a great fucking reference from them. Pardon my French. So all that is true. So make your boss look good, okay? And the second thing is make yourself indispensable. So making yourself indispensable means that everybody understands that you are so valuable. Now, how do people come to the conclusion that you're indispensable? Well, I swear to God, 90% of it is just keep showing up. Just keep showing up. Not switching every year, every 18 months, not jumping ship, you know, just water the grass and fertilize the grass you're standing on, not looking always for greener grass. Just keep showing up. And when you keep showing up, do the shit work that nobody else wants to do. So if you keep showing up and doing the shit work that nobody else wants to do, you're going to be indispensable. And when you're indispensable, your boss is going to understand you're indispensable. And then you're going to get pay raises and you're going to get more options and you're going to get more opportunities because nobody wants to lose you. It is that simple. Now, the problem is that, you know, many people believe that, oh my God, we went through a pandemic and now, you know, we work remotely. So I was working 2 hours a day from Bali or 2 hours a day from Cancun. And now they want me back in the office. And well, I hate to tell you, but you know what? If you want to be remarkable, you got to show up and you got to do the shit work that nobody else wants to do. And if you want to work 2 hours a day from Bali and, you know, okay, God bless you. There's a time and a place for that. But I honestly cannot tell you that I believe that that's going to make you remarkable. And I also will tell you that I'm going to lose all the potential buyers of my book when I say this next thing, which is that do not necessarily pursue this concept of work-life balance. Work-life balance, I think, is a myth. And what happens is that there's going to be times in your life where you're not going to have work-life balance. You're just going to have to work. And there's going to be times in your life when you can have balance, but to constantly be trying to thread the needle where every job has work-life balance, I think is not going to work. You just going to have to show up, do the shit work, and you're going to have to shift that work-life balance towards work and less balance. And you're going to have to make sacrifices. That's the way it is. And, you know, if you don't believe that, there are a lot of other books that can tell you how to achieve this perfect work-life balance and be successful. Go read their books. That's not my book. My book is about you got to earn it.
Love it. I mean, I have one final question, but I just do need to give this example. So about 15 years ago, there's this book that came out. A really good book, by the way. The 4-Hour Workweek. Really good principles.
Tim Ferriss,
really good guy. I mean, I've been following since. I mean, when I read that book, I was, you know, 25. I don't know. Oh, God, that's it. You know, oh, screw this. I mean, screw this work. And then at that time, I didn't really take it at heart. But there was one guy that was ironic at Tim and was saying, you know, Tim, for a guy that wrote a book called The 4-Hour Workweek, you sure spent 80 hours a week promoting your book. And that's kind of, you know, that's kind of, and you can get a 4-hour work week, but, you know, you might make 100K and that's fine. It's like to make, you know, if you want to make millions, and that doesn't need to be the goal of anybody. But if you want to make millions, you're unlikely to do it over a 4, unless you sell drugs, which is highly dangerous. But, you know,
I mean, Don't get me wrong, Tim Ferriss is a friend, and that is a brilliant work title for a book. But I think the concept that you can work 4 hours a week and be highly successful is flawed. I don't know anybody who does that. I mean, knock on wood, prove me wrong, you do that, right? But I'm telling you, show up, do the shit work, make yourself indispensable. That's my formula.
Make your boss look good. Show up. Keep doing the work. Last question for you guys. So, you were with Canva at the very, 2013. I didn't quite look when Canva started, but that must have been at the very beginning of the story. Now they're super successful. So I guess my how did it happen? Like, how did they, how did you find them? Did they find you? How,
Okay,
chemistry?
so this proves that it's better to be lucky than smart. So at the time, I was active on Twitter, and my social media person and I, we came to the conclusion that every tweet should have a video or a picture. So she was using Twitter, she was using Canva to make tweets. And Canva noticed that I was using Canva. So Canva reached out to me and said, Guy, we noticed that you're using our product. We're going to be in the United States soon. We'd love to discuss how we could work together. And so I went to the social media person and I said, isn't this the company we use to make graphics? She goes, yeah. I said, well, is it good? She goes, oh, yeah, it's very good. And I said, should I help them? She said, yeah, help them. And so that was the due diligence. And that's how I found them, which is to say that they found me. And this is my theory of Guy's golden touch, which is not that whatever I touch is gold. Excuse me, I said that wrong. It's not that whatever I touch, I can turn to gold. It's whatever I touch is golden. So that's the key. You touch gold and you declare victory. I'm very good at that. But at least I know that's what I'm doing. And so, would Canva be as successful without me? Yes, there's no doubt in my mind because Melanie Perkins is such a good CEO, and her two co-founders, Cliff Obrick and Cameron Adams, are also excellent people. And I know a lot of companies, and I don't know any company that is more dedicated to perfecting everything they do. Not just engineering, not just marketing, everything they do, they're trying to perfect. And it's like, Lexus, the constant pursuit of perfection. And that's how Canva found me, and that's why it's better to be lucky than smart, because they found me, I didn't find them.
Awesome. Well, guys, been a tremendous pleasure. I cannot suggest strong enough to the people following this to get your book, to follow you, to also listen to
Oh,
the
thank you.
podcast. And thanks a lot for joining us, and I'm really, really grateful for your time.
Oh, one more thing. If you're not a book reader, Canva has a lesson on how to be remarkable that we created so you don't have to read the book. I'll send it to you.
We'll make sure it gets posted in all the right places. And
Okay.
big thanks for joining us and for all your
Oh,
nuggets of wisdom.
it's very fun. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to go to www.elcottglobal.com and click the podcast button for all the show notes of the interview. Also, subscribe to our mailing list to get our latest updates first. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, we would appreciate a kind review. 5-star works best to keep us going and our production team happy. And of course, share it with your friends. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me. And if you have any suggestions on what to do and who to invite next, don't hesitate to drop me a note. And if you're looking to hire top executives or transform your business, of course, contact us as well to find out how we can help.